Is support for childhood vaccinations a partisan issue? Comments made this week by several White House hopefuls seem to suggest so. It's Politics Day on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Hans Hassel are with us this hour to pick apart the politics of the last few days, including the president's latest budget. Also, Jeb Bush plans his Iowa debut, while Scott Walker becomes the one to watch in the race for the Republican nomination, and a new poll that shows 2 in 5 GOP caucus goers see Islam as violent. Join our discussion for this Politics Day. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day has arrived once again. Joining me in the studio, Hans Hassel. He's Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College in our Iowa City studio. Hello, Hans.
Great to be here.
Great to have you with us. In Des Moines, joining us by phone, Dennis Goldford, Professor of Political Science at Drake University, and also Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Welcome back to you, Dennis.
Thank you, Ben, and I'd like to propose a constitutional amendment to ban snow.
that indeed, that it prevented you from getting into our studio today, but so glad you could join us by phone. Number of things we want to talk about this hour. We hope our listeners will join us with any questions or comments, 1-866-780-9100. In a few moments, we want to talk about the president's latest budget that landed on, I guess, with a thud on Capitol Hill. We'll find out about that, perhaps some details offered by our analysts as well. Also, we want to talk about Senator Grassley, now that he's had a few days as the new chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, thoughts on what his agenda will be, and confirmation hearings, of course. Also, we can't avoid now, gentlemen, this is the first Politics Day that is inside the one-year mark for the Iowa caucuses. Dennis, are you excited about that? February 1st, 2016.
Well, I'll tell you, the morning after the election in November, I, in fact, was down at the studio in Des Moines to do On Point until 10. I got back to my office at 10:15, and by 11:30, I had had my first two out-of-state phone calls regarding caucuses.
Okay, so it's in, we won't say full throttle, but it's gearing up.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. We'll get to that a little bit later in the program. But first of all, let's talk about what's some of the top news here. Political repercussions, perhaps, here at home for the global news that we have been absorbing. Yesterday, Islamic State militants releasing a video appearing to show a captured Jordanian pilot being burnt alive in a cage, prompting Jordan to respond by swiftly executing two militants in retaliation. Jordan, we remind ourselves, has been mounting air raids in Syria as part of this U.S. led alliance against the Islamic State in insurgents. Dennis, can you tell me if it's these sort of things, this ongoing, it's not even a year old, the fight against ISIS, how that is shaping politics back here?
Well, you know, with the decline or the disintegration of the Soviet Union at the end of the 1980s, we during the 1990s were on what columnist Charles Krauthammer called a holiday from history. In other words, we tended to think that foreign affairs, foreign policy really were not significant. That changed massively, of course, on September 11th, 2001. And this is simply, I think, a further iteration or indeed aggravation of those difficult problems. We have a situation now in which we are, however quickly or slowly, coming out of the recession, and we still have concerns there and concerns about domestic policies having to do with infrastructure and taxes and all those sorts of things. But foreign affairs, and particularly the belief, especially in the Republican Party, that in so many ways American culture is under attack, either through radical Islam or through illegal immigration, foreign affairs have sort of landed on the doorstep of all campaigns with a resounding thud.
Mm. This at the same time, a new Des Moines Register Bloomberg Politics Iowa poll. We'll be talking about many aspects of that later in the hour as well. But interestingly, in this context, 2 out of 5 Republicans likely to participate in Iowa's presidential caucuses say they are inclined to view Islam as an inherently violent religion that inspires brutality by its followers. Twice as many Democrats, along with a majority of Republicans, say they view the world's second largest religion as inherently peaceful, the same poll found. So a bit of a contradiction there. Hans, your thoughts on how this may shape the field and the debate among the 2016 presidential hopefuls.
Well, you asked, Dennis, how does these foreign affairs affect our politics here? Well, I think that what happens is you've got news media covering these events, and that coverage is something that affects opinions of Americans. What the news covers sets the agenda for the political debate. How they cover it affects their particular views on particular candidates, particular parties. So it's an agenda setting effect is what you're probably seeing here. So I think that this recent news has an effect on the ability of the decisions of candidates to pick which issues they're going to talk about. What are individuals thinking of when they're evaluating these candidates? Are they thinking about terrorism or are they thinking about domestic policy? And so what this really does is it primes the debate for kind of what the issues of debate are going to be in the upcoming months.
Okay, we'll talk more about 2016 candidates later in the program. Let's talk about the president's budget unveiled. His proposed budget for 2016 on Monday, his budget proposing more government spending, more taxes on the wealthy, calls for nearly $4 trillion in spending in the upcoming fiscal year. Here's the president speaking about the budget on Monday.
We've got to put politics aside, pass a budget that funds our national security priorities at home and abroad and gives middle-class families the security they need to get ahead in the new economy. This is one of our most basic and most important responsibilities as a government. So I'm calling on Congress to get this done.
Also on Monday, Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, responding to President's budget on the Senate floor.
He could have proposed a budget that was balanced. He could have challenged us with serious, innovative reforms aimed at getting spending under control or effective ideas to create jobs and opportunity. There's so many positive things he could have done instead of phoning in another tired tax and spend manifesto. We basically see the same thing every year. It focuses on growing the bureaucracy instead of opportunity. It doesn't balance ever. And because it isn't designed to pass Congress, of course it doesn't pass Congress.
Mitch McConnell speaking about the president's budget on Monday. Hans, a starting point for negotiations with Congress, now all in Republican hands, or a budget that is mainly symbolic?
I think this is largely symbolic, unfortunately. I think that what he's done is basically said, here are a couple things that maybe we can work on, and here are some great ideas that I think will really resonate with the Democratic base and will help out candidates in the upcoming elections. And I think that he recognizes that it's almost impossible to get everything he wants with divided government, and so he says, "Well, let's just throw something out there that I can talk about, that I feel comfortable with, and that my constituents, those that voted for me, are going to really like, and Republicans are not going to like." And so, in essence, this happens very frequently in divided government, that the budgets that the president proposes in times of divided government doesn't get anywhere at all.
Dennis, your observations on this latest budget?
Well, I agree with Hans. I think listening to Leader McConnell's criticisms, basically he's criticized the president for not proposing a Republican budget. But, of course, the president's a Democrat, so he proposed a Democratic budget. And as Hans said, with the condition of divided government, the question is whether there's any wiggle room in there, say, infrastructure or trade policy. But to a great extent, I think both sides will use support for opposition to that budget as a way of establishing positions with an eye toward the 2016 presidential elections.
Join our conversation Politics Day on River to River, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Des Moines. James is in Des Moines. James?
I've heard this middle class thrown around so much that I don't even think they know the definition. I know what is not middle class, and that is if you qualify for assistance, housing assistance, food assistance, or anything like that. But this amorphous middle class, they need to define it, and not in their terms. They need to define it in a way that is acceptable to all of us. That's how a language works.
Interesting observation, James. I wish I had the figures with me at the moment, but it is true that many people claim to be in the middle class when actually statistically they're not, Hans.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I remember seeing a poll asking someone, they actually asked people, what's your income? And they also asked people, are you middle class? And the middle class ranged anywhere from like $40,000 a year to about $300,000 a year in annual income. So, yeah, it's a very nebulous definition. And I think intentionally, because they're trying to draw as broad support for particular policies that they can. And what's an easier way to do it than to sell it towards as benefiting the middle class, which is everybody.
Right. We heard that in the State of the Union, didn't we, Dennis, as well? Middle class repeated several times. So that's something that the president's going to be talking about also to prime for 2016.
Well, American elections tend to be fights over support from the middle class, however difficult it is to define that. Something that sort of continues to strike me is that during the 2012 election, a woman came up to me in a mall who was working at one of the stores there, and she said, I'm not middle class. I'm working class. I barely make ends meet. Who's going to speak for me? And you didn't really hear much talk about that, whatever proportion of the population that is. But, yeah, both people tend to think of themselves as middle class, even if their income is way above any reasonable definition of that. And that's where American politics between the parties tends to be fought out.
Okay. James, thank you for that call from Des Moines. You'd like to join our conversation talking about President Obama's budget, the GOP reaction to it, 1-866-780-9100. Let's dig into it just very briefly, some parts of it, jumping out at many commentators that the president wants to drop the top corporate tax rate from 35% to 28%. Republicans probably getting on board with that. However, the president wants to pair that with a new 19% minimum tax on global profits. And from my notes, he's seeking to impose a 14% tax on corporate profits stashed abroad. What are you seeing there, Hans?
I think that Republicans have pretty much said that that's one thing that they won't do right now. And I think that's primarily the main thing that's keeping this budget. The disagreements between the parties is the issue of taxation. The Republicans have essentially said we don't want to see tax increases anywhere, and that's a major stumbling block between the two parties now.
And the Democrats, Dennis, are arguing that these tax cuts for the middle class are valid. On what basis?
Well, the argument, I think, on the Democratic side is a kind of demand-side idea that you're going to stimulate the economy by putting money in people's pockets, in the pockets of people who are going to spend it on goods and services, as opposed to putting money in the pockets of people who are simply going to put it into stocks or bonds or savings accounts, things like that. Corporations are sitting on, I think, what is it, $2 trillion in cash, something like that. But they're not investing. And, you know, the Republican argument is they're not doing that because tax rates are too high. The Democratic argument is there's not enough demand. They're not seeing a way to sell their goods and services, so they're not going to invest and create jobs.
Anthony is joining us from Fredericksburg. Hello, Anthony. Welcome to River to River.
Thank you. I love your show.
Thank you.
I actually have a perfect way to define the middle class.
Okay.
If you think back to the 50s and 60s, right, it had been a single working parent, owned a house, they owned two cars, and they put their kids through college as opposed to today where you're lucky to have a house, you're lucky to have two cars, and odds are pretty good that your kids are going to be putting themselves through college.
And racking up a considerable debt.
Yeah, so if you're not making $100,000, $80,000, you're not middle class, you're poor.
Okay.
You know, if you take the two drastic sides of it, that's what they considered middle class would have been, you know, that option. And to do that today, you're going to have to make at least that much.
Okay. Interestingly, the Pew Research published a study today that found that the share of adults who live in middle-income households has eroded over time. You were talking, Anthony, going back in time 61% were in the middle class, or that as that was defined then in 1970, 61% down to 51% by 2013. Anthony, thank you for your call from Fredericksburg. 1-866-780-9100. Let's see. What else is in this? Climate change. The president proposing boosting funding for clean energy by 7%, a new $4 billion fund to encourage U.S. states to make faster and deeper cuts to emissions from power plants. Dennis, is this a point of conflict or cooperation?
Oh, conflict. I mean, you know, there are two levels of the argument. Number one, are we facing global warming? And you've got some folks who argue, no, we don't have enough data to say that we are, or at least we're not. So there's an argument over whether, in fact, overall the oceans are warming or the climate is warming. And then second, the second argument, and that's where it gets more directly contentious between Republicans and Democrats, the question is, if in fact things are warming, is this a result of human activities, such as carbon emissions? Or is it a result of non-human natural kinds of things over which we have no particular control? But to a great extent for Republicans generally, and especially for conservative Republicans, the whole Democratic focus on global warming is an attempt to attack, in their view, the free enterprise capitalist system.
Hans, your thoughts?
The other thing I was going to point out about this budget that I think is interesting or relevant to this budget is that the polarizing nature of the presidency causes most of these issues to become polarized. So we may say now, oh, it looks like there's agreement, there's a possibility for agreement on these issues. Just the fact of President Obama taking a stance on some of these issues polarizes the party. There's a great anecdote about the mission to Mars back in the early 2000s when President George W. Bush floated this idea prior to a State of the Union address. There's been some polling done previously that showed that, you know, about half of Democrats and half of Republicans thought that this was an interesting idea, you know, to take a mission to Mars, get an individual there. This idea was floated by President Bush. It went in the media for a week or two. And there was a pull down immediately afterwards, and the issue was entirely polarized. Democrats were against it, Republicans were for it. Mm-hmm. And so I think just the fact that we're talking about these in a context of President Obama is proposing these ideas will cause these issues to become more polarized than perhaps that we see them now.
Dennis, you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, things are such that if President Obama came out for daily brushing of our teeth, I think Republicans would oppose that.
David is with us in Des Moines. Hi, David. You want to talk about brushing your teeth or probably closer to politics?
a little bit closer to politics. I just want to say thank you for taking my call. I really do appreciate
that. Sure thing.
I have a quick comment and also a question. So my comment is, I don't really think that it matters if you're a Democrat or a Republican. I don't see how a $4 trillion budget can help anybody in the long term. If you look at it, I mean, all it does is it weakens the dollar in the long run, and it adds more debt to the economy. I mean, we're already, what, $18 trillion? Do we need another two added once, you know, it all shakes out? And then my question is, you mentioned here just a minute ago, the middle class is $40,000 to $300,000. Is that per household or is that per individual earner? Because if it's just per house, then you can be at $25,000 really and be middle class.
Right. That wasn't clear. Per house, I think Hans, you threw that out. I don't know if that was an individual or a household.
I don't remember what that was, unfortunately. There was a poll that was like 3 or 4 years old. So I remember reading about it in the news, but I don't remember the exact figures to it.
And again, that's as a poll, that's what people thought. That doesn't mean they were accurate.
Yeah, right.
$300,000 a year is not middle class, even if you allow for differences between Des Moines and either New York or San Francisco.
Okay, let's take up David's first point there about the budget deficit. There's a $4 trillion budget, but massive federal budget deficits have been coming down?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that David asked this question about, is this reasonable? And I think in part of this, that you're getting at the fundamental difference between the parties here. Their focus is different. I think that both parties really have good intentions, but their focus is entirely different. I think that the Democrats here are saying, well, how can we better encourage the well-being of the middle class, the lower class, and other individuals. Whereas Republicans are very much focused on this idea of how does this budget deficit in the long run hurt the economy? And I think that both of them are focused on bettering the country as a whole, but there are different ways that they want to go about and do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 1-866-780-9100. I want to try to go to Eric. Eric in Dallas Center. Hi, Eric.
Hi. You know, the previous caller mentioned that the $4 trillion budget and really was that necessary because it's going to add to the deficit. You know, and I think part of the problem there is when we decide how we're going to spend that money, what we're going to spend that money on, I mean, we've got laws that need to be funded. And so basically somebody's decided that these things were necessary.
Right.
So that means we got to fund them. And if we don't fund them, it's not a problem of spending necessarily as much as finding the revenue to use it. Either that or we've got to go back and really have a big discussion about what we're going to do and get rid of things. Or, you know, but it has to be things that don't affect the people who need government assistance because of their circumstance.
Right.
Anyway, that's all I got to say.
And Eric, to your point here, let's go to another point from the Obama budget. Expanding preschool would triple the Education Department's preschool development grants to $750 million, adding $1 billion of new funding to Head Start, some other things in there. Dennis, education a point where an area where the two parties, at least to a degree, can see eye to eye?
Well, there's been some argument on the Republican side that programs like Head Start really don't make a huge difference in school children. And, of course, that's hotly debated, but that's an argument they've been making. But this gets wrapped up with the whole issue of Common Core, because even though initially this is something that President Bush, George W., supported, along with Teddy Kennedy and others, which itself is the kiss of death for Republicans today, they're concerned that about the imposition of national standards on state and local education authorities, and they don't want that. So, again, the main thrust of the Republican Party is to oppose anything that looks as though it's a mandate from Washington. Even, you know, they'll argue money always comes with strings.
From Grinnell, our listener, Suzanne or Susan? Suzanne.
Suzanne.
Suzanne Van Grinnell, welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you. I don't really have an axe to grind here. I just wanted to say that I think that middle class, the term middle class is being used in two different ways. One of the callers or several of the callers was using it as a sort of a proxy for what one ought to be able to achieve as, you know, a good standard of living in what we're striving for in this country. And I think that your guests, and the people who are making these Pew studies, et cetera, are using it in sort of a technical way. Well, what is technically in the middle? And so I think we're talking about two different things there, and it's there is something there about the American dream and what is it that we think that this economy ought to support and how many people it ought to support at that level that ought to be talked about, and I think that's kind of what the people in politics are trying to gear their speech
towards. Yes, excellent point. Suzanne in Grinnell, thank you for that call. As Politics Day here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, we have with us Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Hans Hassel of Cornell College. Finished up talking about the president's budget. When we come back, we want to talk about Senator Grassley, now that he's a few days been the new chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. What's on his agenda, see if we can see by his first actions and comments what he has in mind for that forum. Also, 2016, with it now less than a year away, the Iowa caucuses, we want to measure the field, have our analysts do that, rather. And we'll be back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we listen back to an encore edition from last summer of a program we did about landfills. Very interesting. Where does our waste go when it goes to a landfill? And also talk about how waste can actually generate energy tomorrow on this program. It's Politics Wednesday today. Dennis Goldford of Drake University with us, where he is professor of political science. Also, Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College, lending us their expertise today to reflect on recent political goings-on. We talked about the president's budget in the first half hour. Let's spend a moment to reflect on the fact that the new chair of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Charles Grassley, of course of Iowa, took the reins a few days ago in the first major confirmation hearing of the new Congress, the confirmation hearing of Loretta Lynch, the federal prosecutor who's nominated to become the next attorney general. I wonder, Dennis, any reason to believe that Lynch won't be confirmed?
Well, you know, Ted Cruz has suggested that her nomination ought to be put on hold until the president does something, or the Republicans at least force the president to do something with regard to his executive orders on immigration. The question is whether Senator Grassley and Majority Leader McConnell will allow that to happen, or will they push something through? I mean, I think they do recognize we need to have an attorney general. The question will be whether they want to fight Ted Cruz.
And right, and Eric Holder will be the attorney general until Loretta Lynch is or is not confirmed. So they have someone there they would like to unseat, correct?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm. To your point of the larger context in which this Loretta Lynch confirmation plays itself out, I'd like to play for you a clip from Senator Grassley, comments from his opening remarks at the Loretta Lynch confirmation last Wednesday, because here in this short comment, I think we can get an idea of what he has on his agenda. Let's listen to Senator Grassley.
There are challenges facing the Department of Justice that go to the heart of our system of government. How about restoring faith in the bedrock principles like respect for the rule of law and the fair and even-handed application of those laws? How about restoring respect for the co-equal branches of government? How about taking care that the law is faithfully executed and not rewritten? How about the Department of Justice honoring, once again, its longstanding duty to vigorously defend our nation's laws, even when political appointees disagree with the policy?
Hans Hassel, what do you hear in Grassley's comments there?
Well, I hear a struggle to take control of the bureaucracy. Both the president and Congress have methods of control over the federal bureaucracy. The Department of Justice is one of those agencies within the federal bureaucracy. And so what I hear Grassley saying is, we're going to use and exercise our abilities that we have, our oversight, our ability to call people into hearings, our ability to try to make sure that the Department of Justice is doing what Congress wants it to do, not necessarily what the president wants it to do. And there's always this struggle whenever there's divided government. Both branches of government have means to control the bureaucracy. When there's not divided government, the Congress basically says to the president, go do what you want. But when there is divided government, there's always this tussle over who's going to control the reins and give direction to the bureaucracy about what they should be doing.
Now that the GOP is in the majority in the Senate, Dennis, and Grassley is at the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, what's changed? And also hearkening back to Grassley's remarks there.
Well, what he did was articulate the standard or ongoing Republican critique of President Obama, arguing it's not just simply a matter of policy differences, but that the president, in the view of Republicans, has acted unconstitutionally or illegally. And so they're very concerned about that, but they are, of course, grounded in policy differences. But I think what you're looking at is a case, simply as Hans said, of the results of divided government. And the key thing, I think, that makes the difference with the Republican control of the Senate is with regard to treaties and nominations. They have a role and House members don't. But what the Republicans in the Senate now have is what the Republicans gained in the House after the 2010 elections. They have control of the agenda, and more significantly, they have the control of administrative oversight and investigations. So they can establish all sorts of committees and subcommittees to investigate things and haul members of the administration and others up to answer their concerns.
Dennis, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that the agenda control is huge because it sets the floor for what's going to be talked about, and that
right.
affects the media coverage, and that affects opinions and perceptions of government in general.
Let's pivot a little bit in our political politics day discussion with Dennis and Hans. The 2016 Iowa caucuses just over a year away, scheduled for February 1st, 2016. A few developments on that front in the past few days. We just heard that Jeb Bush will make his Iowa debut of the 2016 presidential election cycle. Next month, in March, he intends to speak at the Iowa Ag Summit in Des Moines on March 7th. The only major GOP contender considering a presidential bid who has yet to step foot in this election cycle in Iowa. Give me Jeb Bush's strengths and weaknesses from your perspective, Dennis.
Well, strengths are he is seen right now, despite the fact that he was always considered very conservative. In some ways, he was considered more conservative than his brother, George W. Bush. But he is seen right now as more center-right or more moderate compared to people like Ted Cruz and Huckabee and Santorum and people like that. And he has access to long lists of donors and supporters in that wing of the Republican Party, the more center-right wing, business-oriented wing. So that speaks to his advantage. The disadvantage is that even aside from Bush fatigue, which is the Republican version of Clinton fatigue, in other words, aren't there other people to run besides people from these families, he's mistrusted by the more populist Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. Despite his support for Terry Schiavo in that incident years ago when he was governor, but he's mistrusted because of his position on immigration and Common Core.
Well, yeah, I was going to say the strengths here, as I think Dennis hit on very well, is the connection that he has with the party elites. Mm-hmm. If we want to look and try to understand where the presidential primary is going, it's not the polls that are going to tell us that. It's where are the party elites going? And you're going to see a winnowing of the field, this invisible primary where the party support and party elites are playing an active role in supporting and making candidates viable.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about the presidential stage newcomer, Scott Walker. He's become, in some people's eyes, the one to watch in the race for this Republican nomination. The new Des Moines Register Bloomberg Politics Iowa poll of likely Republican contenders, caucus goers, I should say, puts him at 15 percentage points. It's a tightly packed field, though. So he's at the top. He gave a speech at the recent Freedom Summit in Des Moines. And let's hear just a moment of that, because it was, I think, reviewed as one of the best, if not the best, speeches at the Freedom Summit. He talked about growing up poor in a small town, talked about being scolded by his wife for buying something full price at Kohl's.
Now, some of you don't know this, but I actually went to school in Plainfield, Iowa, until the middle of third grade. And then my father got called to a church in Delavan, Wisconsin, and that's where our family moved to, and that's where I graduated from high school. But I got to tell you, in all the years I was in school, doesn't matter whether it was in Plainfield or Delavan here in Iowa or Wisconsin, there was never a time when I heard one of my classmates say to me, Hey, Scott, someday when I grow up, I want to become dependent on the government, right? That's not the American dream, is it?
Scott Walker talking at the Freedom Summit recently in Des Moines. Hans Hassel, what do you see in his appeal to Iowans?
Well, I think that coming from Wisconsin, he's got that Midwest heritage, and I think that that's going to be a powerful influence in going forward as he continues to campaign here. I wish I could say that the poll is very predictive of what's going to happen, but unfortunately, polls that are more than even 100 days out are little better than a coin flip. So you look at that tightly packed field, and you say any one of those candidates could emerge as a favorite candidate. So I think that Scott Walker has a lot going for him. He's gone through some tough campaigns in Wisconsin in the past, so we know he knows how to campaign. He knows how to do a good fight. But I really think his major asset is that proximity. People are perhaps a little bit more familiar with him and feel comfortable because he's another Midwesterner.
Pollster Ann Selzer, who's been on this program commenting about this poll and Walker's first place in this. And granted, Rand Paul was a very close second, I think, at 14%. Dennis, she commented to the Register, he's in a sweet spot. People who don't want an ultra-conservative think he's okay, and people who don't want a moderate think he's okay.
Well, I was at that summit. I gave it 9.5 hours of my life and listened to everybody. And it was very interesting. And I don't know. I mean, Walker's considered somewhat, he's considered not Cruz or Huckabee or Santorum because he's a sitting governor. But he actually is quite conservative. But he was somebody who's not very well known. And as I sat and watched that speech, aside from the sort of relentless self-promotion in which he was engaged, others were more subtle in the way they presented themselves. Here was somebody introducing himself to an Iowa audience or Iowa Republican activists, and he rang the right bells or checked the right boxes, right? He grew up in small town. He went to school in Iowa. He grew up in small town Iowa for a while. He's a pastor's kid. And in particular, he talked about very dramatically the way he received and his family received threats from people opposing him in Wisconsin. And that sort of confirmed very well the worldview of people who think that our American way of life, at least as these folks understand it, is under attack. And he presented himself as somebody who's fought that battle and is capable and willing to fight that battle.
Mm-hmm. And since our last politics day, Mitt Romney exiting the pool of hopefuls, who did that benefit most, Hans?
I think that benefits those that are kind of priming the establishment. That gets rid of one additional individual. One of the things that I thought was very interesting coming out of that was the rush of the news stories focus particularly on the rush to try to woo Spencer Zwick, who was Mitt Romney's chief financial advisor. Campaign fundraiser, and they know that he has access to these lists and access to these donors that are going to be critical to giving potential candidates the ability to compete and to be viable in this primary. And so I think the winners are those people that are closest to him, are those people that were in the competing for that same set of donors. It's not the Ted Cruz's, it's not the Santorums and the Huckabees, it's the kind of centrist Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, Scott Walker. Individuals on that field.
Politics Day, Hans Hassel with us of Cornell College, Dennis Goldford of Drake University in Des Moines. Join our conversation 1-866-780-9100 as we talk about the 2016 field of presidential hopefuls, just 1 year away from the Iowa caucuses. 1 year from now, we'll be digesting the results, as will the nation and the world, for that matter. This week, gentlemen, vaccination entered the political spotlight. Not that it's not been there before. On Monday, Rand Paul helped set off an uproar when he said, in the context of a national measles outbreak in this country, that parents should be allowed to decide whether their children needed to be vaccinated, and that he'd heard from parents whose children had suffered, quote, profound mental disorders after being vaccinated. Rand Paul made the following comment on CNBC Monday after first asserting that vaccines should be optional on the Laura Ingraham show that morning. Let's listen to Rand Paul.
I've heard of many tragic cases of walking, talking, normal children who wound up with profound mental disorders after vaccines. I'm not arguing vaccines are a bad idea. I think they're a good thing. But I think the parents should have some input. The state doesn't own your children. Parents own the children, and it is an issue of freedom.
By Tuesday, Rand Paul was insisting his comments on vaccine had been misconstrued. He says, I did not say vaccines caused disorders, just that they were temporally related. I did not allege causation. So he's, what do you make of all this? Certainly, Chris Christie's in this, too. I don't know if you want to relay that, Dennis. This has blown up here. What do you make of it?
Well, it's a difficult position for at least more mainstream politicians to be in, because it's an interesting confluence of demographics. The people who are suspicious of vaccines, on the one hand, are folks who might have religious objections or suspicion of science or suspicion of government. And at the same time, there's been attention to folks, Hans, I think it's Marin County out in California, something like that, very well-to-do people who probably are descendants of the old hippie movement, so to speak, but people who are very green and environmental and all in favor of natural things, and they don't want to put what they believe are unnatural things in the bodies of their children. And these two groups of people normally wouldn't agree with each other that the sun comes up in the east. But on this particular issue, they seem to have a common position, which is the suspicion of vaccinations, whereas most mainstream people and the overwhelming medical science on this says, no, these don't hurt you, they're necessary, they're important. And politicians are concerned about if they sound too much on the fringe, that's going to endanger them.
Mm. Chris Christie was also in the mix here, even though he was in England. He noted that his kids had been vaccinated, but then added in a conversation, in an interview, I also understand that parents need to have some measure of choice in things as well. So that's the balance that the government has to decide. This prompted a bit of a backlash, and he had to reissue a statement, Hans?
Well, I think the most concerning thing about this is that it's turning a issue that, as Dennis said, has largely been bipartisan. I mean, it's been pockets on both sides.
Science has decided this.
Yes, this is well-established fact that there is no connection at all between vaccinations and mental disabilities. There was one study published, and that study was retracted after the data was found to have been falsified. The problem with it becoming a partisan issue is that it becomes much more difficult to change people's minds about this sort of thing. That as issues become partisan, it becomes more associated with a mental emotion rather than a critical thinking aspect. And that's problematic. There's very interesting research by Brendan Nehan of Dartmouth College where he talks about how do you get rid of misinformation in political systems. And one thing you don't want to do is make it more partisan. Mm. If you make it more partisan, it becomes harder to change minds.
I would think the Republican strategists would have a sense of deja vu, and we want to bring that back to you with a little bit of audio from a few years ago. Michelle Bachmann made this comment about this topic. Now, was on the Today Show on September 13th of 2011. This is after a presidential primary debate for the 2012 election where she criticized Rick Perry for requiring all young women to get an HPV vaccination. And here's what she had to say that made quite a media splash.
Well, I will tell you that I had a mother last night come up to me here in Tampa, Florida, after the debate. She told me that her little daughter took that vaccine, that injection, and she suffered from mental retardation thereafter. It can have very dangerous side effects. The mother was crying.
Okay. Dennis, do you believe deja vu was going on?
Well, I think that's the concern on the part of the folks like Rand Paul and Chris Christie who took a step in that direction because Congresswoman Bachmann was roundly criticized and indeed ridiculed for that claim from people who argued there's simply no substance to it, and I don't remember that she could even produce the woman she claimed she had talked to. So, again, I think for a lot of these folks, Congresswoman Bachmann sort of hung a big, I don't know, I can't think of the word, but she undermined her candidacy or her credibility mm-hmm. by that comment. And Christie and Paul don't want to get to that territory.
Well, I think this is disconcerting, though, Dennis, because, I mean, Bachmann was roundly criticized for it. I'm not sure that this, I mean, she was already in some sense an extreme candidate who had a very outside chance of winning the nomination. Mm-hmm. And here you've got Rand Paul, Chris Christie, these are major names within the party that have legitimate shots at winning the presidential nomination. And I think, to me, it's deja vu, but it's disconcerting because it's not just the candidate on the fringe, it's the candidates that some establishment elites have come out and supported.
Right. If they wander in that fringe direction, it's even more dangerous to them, precisely as you say, because they have that realistic chance.
Jeb Bush today, speaking to the Detroit Economic Club, said, quote, parents ought to make sure their children are vaccinated. So we see their clear separation. They're making it very, very clear. Let's talk. We have just a couple minutes left. Let's touch on this because it happened just yesterday. The House voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. More than 50 times this has happened in the past 4 years, to repeal the law in part or as a whole. This was the first time it was voted to repeal in its entirety since 2013. So what does this mean in the new Congress, Dennis?
It's political posturing. It's an attempt to put people on the record supporting it or opposing it. And there was an interesting story this morning, of course, that for the first time there were no Democrats who voted to repeal it, because basically any Democrats who were in districts that were against it have already been voted out of office or they retired. So it really was a party line vote, although I think there were about 10 people not voting overall.
There were a few Republicans that
That's
voted.
Right. There were a couple of Republicans who did oppose. I think there were three.
Yeah, that's one of the things I thought was really interesting, is that the rationale that those Republicans gave for supporting that particular bill was that it was already in place. Now we've got people on these health insurance, and so if we cut them, we're hurting these individuals. And so their rationale for not voting for a repeal was, we need to not just repeal, but we need to replace, and we need to come up with some other viable alternative. Once you've got people on these programs, it's much more difficult to take them away than to just not start them. I think that's the different context in which these votes are going to be taken in the next congressional cycle.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Republicans would have to explain to a couple of million people why they don't anymore have health insurance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we are waiting. In just over a month, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear that case, the claim that tax credits are available only for health plans sold through the marketplace run by states, not for plans sold through a marketplace run by the federal government on behalf of states. And so that will be interesting to see how that comes out, but we're waiting weeks or months for that. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University, Flansburgh Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, and Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. Thank you so much for your insights, gentlemen.
It's been great to be here.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We'll listen back to a program about landfills and how we can create energy with our waste tomorrow on this program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.